Welcome to the THA-TDH Weekly COVID-19 Call. My name is Jenny. I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Patrice Mayo. Patrice, you may begin.
Okay. Good morning. I apologize for the technical difficulties that we had this morning and for getting off to a little bit of a late start. This is Patrice Mayo in the Safety Center at Tennessee Hospital Association. I'd like to welcome you to today's call. This is our every other week opportunity for hospitals to hear from and ask questions of the Tennessee Department of Health. And I'd like to thank Dr. Mary Margaret Phil and Dr. Morgan McDonald for joining us as usual on today's call. Dr. Phil, I will turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, Patrice. Good morning, everybody, and happy Friday on this Labor Day weekend. Thanks for joining us. I have a few updates I wanted to walk through that hopefully many of you are aware of, but just in case, we certainly want to be sure that everyone is aware of these changes. And then I'll discuss some EPI updates statewide, as well as just a reminder about some current CDC guidance and best practices. And then I'll turn it over to Dr. McDonald for some updates on the COVID-specific nursing homes and surge staffing support. So first, hopefully, as many of you saw yesterday, we've made a few updates and kind of a refresh to some of the data that we're presenting on the website. I think the first and most important change to note is that we've changed how we calculate our active cases. So as you probably recall, previously we calculated active cases by removing cases that were deceased or who we were deeming recovered. Initially in the pandemic, we were trying to keep track of people through the course of their illness and manually note when they had recovered. As that quickly became challenging to keep up with, we applied an automatic 21-day cutoff where 21 days after your illness onset or your specimen collection date, if you were asymptomatic, then you would automatically be counted as recovered. However, as we've learned more about this virus and recognized that the infectious period for most people is closer to 10 to 14 days, and that many communities were using this active metric as a marker of community transmission and disease burden in their communities, we thought it was important to update how we calculate that. So we will no longer be reporting just recovered cases. We've updated that calculation to be inactive slash recovered. We really think inactive is a more accurate term, but we recognize that, you know, changing terminology on people in the middle of a pandemic can be a little bit confusing. So starting yesterday, individuals that are 14 days past their illness onset date or specimen collection date who are not deceased will be captured in that inactive slash recovered category. And then all of those folks will be removed from the total cases to determine the active case count. So our active cases decreased by almost 20,000 yesterday, not surprisingly. Again, this doesn't mean there was any sudden change, just trying to keep up with the current science and make sure that our metrics are really accurately reflecting our data and how people are using them. The other thing to note from yesterday is that we had about 1,700 cases dating back to the beginning of the pandemic. So this is about 1% of all of our cases total, where originally their county of residence had been classified based on their zip code alone. And as many of you may know, zip codes often straddle county lines. And so these 1,700 cases had been misclassified to the wrong county based on their zip code. So those were all corrected yesterday, which caused a little bit of fluctuation. There were probably 10 or 15 counties that had a net change in their cases, either up or down by over 20. Obviously, in some of our rural areas of the state, those numbers were more noticeable than in, for example, Memphis or Davidson County. This obviously doesn't at all impact how those cases were handled during their case investigation or contact tracing. And then the other things to note are sort of more informational. So we've refreshed the landing page of our website to now more prominently display the change from the prior day versus the cumulative total. We will also now be reporting the number of current hospitalizations on that main website landing page versus the cumulative hospitalization number. That cumulative number is still available on the full sort of data PDF that's generated every day. It is there in multiple places, but that's, as we all know, more of a marker of disease severity among our cases, not really a marker of current healthcare system strain. And then we've changed our epidemic curve that's on the main website. Instead of having a cumulative case count, which I think we can all agree is not really helpful anymore, to having a seven-day moving average. And then the last resources that I just want to make sure everyone is aware of, one of which is brand new, is a new county data snapshot. So on the main landing page, if you click the map to go to the full data report, there's a series of 9 tiles. And there, one of those says County Snapshot. And it has a nice dashboard that's available by county that looks at the epidemic curve of cases, case rates over the last couple of weeks, and provides a comparison and trends over the last month. It provides data on laboratory testing volume and percent positivity. It links to the current White House task force map and color for that county. And then it also is available as a PDF download. So we hope that that will provide a more real-time, succinct snapshot of what's happening in counties across the state. So I do want to just provide a few then epi updates from the last couple of weeks. So, you know, I think overall we continue to see very reassuring trends in many parts of the state with, you know, continued downward declines in cases in many of the large metro areas and surrounding jurisdictions. I would say in the last few days, we have seen a bit of a plateau or perhaps maybe a little bit of a more worrisome flag in parts of more rural West Tennessee and kind of the Upper Cumberland Plateau area, you know, Cookeville and surrounding counties, where we're seeing increasing numbers of cases in some of those jurisdictions. And we're also seeing a rising percent positivity in many counties across the state. So we had been down as low as less than 10 counties that had less than 15% of tests that were positive over the last week. As of yesterday, we now have 29 counties with a percent positive greater than 15%. So again, you know, not one particular thing to pinpoint right now, but I think something that we're certainly closely monitoring. We do continue to see really a plateau in hospitalizations. We had seen that decline really for the last, 6 to 8 plus weeks, and really have plateaued kind of at the right around 900 admitted patients across the state. Again, quite a bit of variability region by region. We continue to see a rising number of hospitalized patients, again, in the West Tennessee area and sort of the Upper Cumberland Plateau, as is not shocking given what we're seeing in the case trends there as well. And then two sort of points of reminders I just wanted to mention. One of these we discussed on our weekly NHSN and long-term care facility call, but you know, many of you are aware that CDC has some surge staffing guidance for facilities, and in it there is a carve-out that allows the consideration of having staff that have tested positive for COVID-19 basically continue working. And, you know, I think we certainly recognize that in some parts of the country and maybe even in parts of Tennessee a couple of months ago, we might have been at that crisis point, but we are not at that crisis point right now. And so, you know, in conversation with leadership of the department and our group with the licensure, you know, the department feels very strongly that we should not be having positive staff work. Obviously, once they've completed their 10-day isolation period, then they can return to work with no additional testing needed or additional precautions required. But they really do need to complete that required isolation period, the 10 days, including a minimum of 24 hours of being afebrile and seeing improvement in their symptoms. And then along those same lines, I think there still continues to be a lot of, you know, discussion and around utilizing a symptom-based versus a test-based strategy to end isolation and precautions for individuals with COVID-19. You know, now probably a month or more ago, CDC updated their guidance when we moved to the 10 days plus 24 hours, to also reinforce that two negative tests 24 hours apart is really not needed to document that someone is not infectious. We know that many individuals shed this virus for a long period of time. And you know what, let me be clear. I think that's not the appropriate word. Viral RNA is detectable in many patients. Pieces of virus is detectable in many patients for a prolonged period of time. The whole point is that they are not shedding infectious virus. And CDC, as well as others, have done, viral culture studies to understand how long live virus is able to be isolated from patients. And we see that for the vast majority of non-hospitalized patients, it's right around 10 days. There's a really big drop-off, and live virus is not able to be recovered from patients any longer. Certainly, we recognize that people that are critically ill, people that are hospitalized, people that have underlying, weakened immune systems or immunosuppression may be infectious for longer, and so they indicate considering a 20-day isolation period for that group. But recognizing that some people will test positive by PCR for 60, 90, 100 plus days after their original test, requiring those two negative tests 24 hours apart, sometimes it's just not, it's challenging, it's not really always feasible, and I also don't know that it necessarily means what we all think that it means sometimes, just inherently. So we just want to reinforce that we support using that symptom-based strategy for the discontinuation of isolation precautions. There's a full CDC sort of decision memo around this change that really outlines the evidence that we'll be sure to send out in the notes after the call. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. McDonald for other updates that she may have.
Thanks, Dr. Phil. Appreciate you're clearly distilling a lot of really complex and important information. So to build on some of what Dr. Phil had noted, we are thankfully seeing overall a decline in hospitalizations due to COVID over the last 6 weeks or so, but as she mentioned, generally a plateau over the last week or so. Our total percent of floor beds that are occupied due to COVID across the state is now 9.3%. It was upwards of 12 to 13% at our peak, and our percentage of ICU patients hospitalized due to COVID is now 17.6% and had been at its peak about 23%. And again, significant variability across the state, certainly West, Upper Cumberland, and Northeast experiencing some increases notably, while other regions in the state are experiencing decreases. And with that in mind, we've, of course, moved forward with assistance for hospitals and really relief funding and to facilitate additional bed capacity, knowing that hopefully the downward trend that we see now will continue, but we are closing upon winter and fall and certainly can't guarantee that. And so want to make sure that you have resources at your disposal to increase particularly staffing in order to achieve the surge capacity that you are needing and will likely continue to need. And so the two processes that we now have in place, so the update since our last call was that those two processes are long-awaited processes are now in place. We released an FAQ last Friday regarding the supplemental staffing program via the CARES relief funding, the COVID relief funding that has been granted to the state. And that FAQ went out last Friday, and eligible hospitals, as we make clear in that FAQ, are determined every 14 days. And what we look at is, so starting on September 1st, we look at the prior 14-day period. And then if in either of those 2 weeks prior, hospitals had adult staff floor bed utilization averaging above 75%, with more than 10% COVID occupancy. That's one qualifying criteria. The second qualifying criteria is adult staffed bed utilization averaging above 85%, and 6% of that is due to COVID. And then the third qualifying criteria is adult staff bed utilization averaging 70% or more. I'm sorry, adult ICU staff bed utilization averaging 70% or more, and 30% of that being due to COVID. And so there are three ways that hospitals can qualify over that 14-day period. And then those that determination, as I said, is made every 2 weeks, so every other Tuesday through December. And once hospitals are identified as meeting one of those criteria, they're eligible to submit staffing expenses up to $259,000 over a four-week period. And those eligible staffing costs really are intended to increase bed capacity and provide care for COVID conditions. And so the expectation is an increase in beds either in that prior period or in the upcoming period of 6 ICU beds or 12 floor beds or some combination of that. And facilities that may not have the facility space to do that, but may still be able to increase to some degree, can submit a proposal for a prorated amount of funding to, again, be put towards staffing to be able to increase bed capacity according to the limits of their floor space. So that, as I mentioned, was released officially last week. We did the first data poll on Tuesday the 1st. About 40 hospitals qualified across the state. And then we had a onboarding webinar yesterday afternoon with a good bit of discussion. And we will update our FAQs according to those questions that were asked yesterday. And then the second process that we have been able to put into place since our last call is COVID-specific long-term care facilities. And so we have currently facilities in the Memphis metropolitan area and the Nashville metropolitan area and then West Tennessee that are accepting COVID transfers. So these are patients who are eligible for nursing home long-term care facility care. As either coming from the hospital, so those patients that would otherwise be eligible for that level of care and who are COVID positive can move into those units. Likewise, patients who may be in another long-term care facility who test COVID positive can be moved into the COVID-specific units. The intent being both to offload hospital capacity to increase bed availability in hospitals, as well as to be able to better cohort patients within long-term care facilities to prevent spread within facilities. We're working closely with TennCare on this arrangement, as well as with Aventa from a quality management perspective. There are significantly higher requirements from a quality perspective, dedicated staffing, entrances, equipment that go into these units, really with the intent of providing the highest level of care for those patients that are COVID positive. And those are the two major updates that I have. We have additional facilities in other regions that will be coming online over the next week or so, with some potentially even being identified today. So as that information becomes available, we'll obviously continue to get that out to you through THA and very much appreciate your willingness to really contribute to these both of these processes and mold them in a way that is useful for hospitals as we're working together to increase bed capacity. So with that, I'll pause, and I think, Patrice, we're probably ready for questions unless there are other items on the agenda.
Okay, thank you so very much. Jenny, will you please open the lines for questions and instruct the audience on how to ask?
Thank you. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone.
Thank you.
And that's star then one for questions.
Okay.
And we have no questions at this moment.
And let's wait another minute to see if there's any any questions.
And once again, that's star then one. And that's star then one for questions.
And we'll wait another 30 seconds and see if there are any questions.
And as a reminder, that's star then one on your touch tone phone. And we do have a question from Robert Hall. Robert, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was asking, I have a question that when you were saying that you regrouped by the counties by using their zip code, what methodology did you use to do that?
Yes, sir. So the county misassignment was because it was originally coded based solely on zip code. So we used the full street address instead to better and more accurately classify the county.
Okay.
And that's star then one for questions.
We'll wait just another 30 seconds for any additional questions. Okay, with no additional questions, we'll conclude our call today. We will forward the CDC decision memo that was mentioned out to hospitals. I'd like to thank Dr. Phil and Dr. McDonald and all of the hospitals participating in today's call. Our next call is scheduled for Friday, September the 18th at 10 o'clock Central Time. And on behalf of PHA, I'd like to wish everyone a relaxing and safe Labor Day weekend.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.